Chapter 26. The Tunnel and the Station. Scratching. The Trolley House. Red Molly. The Welcoming Party. A Mother's Grief. 1. I think the tunnel was a little over a mile and a half long from the officials' room to where we finally emerged, but at the time, with only a single lantern to lead us, it seemed to go on forever. It tended always upward, broken every now and again by short flights of stairs, 6 in one, 8 in another, 4 in a third. Then it took a square turn to the right, and there were more steps, this time a longer flight. By then, Murph could no longer support Freed, so Amit was carrying him. When I made it to the top, I paused to get my wind back, and Amit caught up to me. Not breathing hard at all, either, curse him.
"Freed says he knows where this comes out," Amit said. "Tell him."
Freed looked up at me. In the pale glow of the lantern, his face was a horror of lumps, bruises, and cuts. Those he might recover from, but the leg wound was infected. I could smell it.
"I sometimes came with the officials in the old days," Freed said. "The judges and boundary men. To doctor the cuts and breaks and broken heads, you understand? It wasn't like the fair one, murder for the sake of murder, but..."
A word I couldn't translate.
"Was plenty rough."
The rest of our merry band was bunched below us on the stairs. We couldn't afford to stop, but I needed to know what was ahead, so I cranked my fist at the dock, telling him to go on, but to make it fast.
"We didn't use the tunnel to come to the Field of the Monarchs, but we often used it when we left. Always if Empus lost because of calls that enraged the crowd."
"Kill the ump," I said.
"Eh?"
"Never mind. Where does it come out?"
"The Trolley House, of course."
Freed managed a feeble smile.
"Because, you must understand, when Empus lost a match, it was wise to leave the city as soon as possible."
"How close is this trolley house to the main gate?" Freed said what I wanted to hear and feared I would not.
"Quite close."
"Let's go," I said. I almost added hump hump, but didn't. That was the language of our captors, and I wanted none of their belittling talk. We'd done for 7 of them. No matter how it went at the end of the tunnel, there was that. "Who still has buckets with water in them?" I called back. 6 did, but none were full. I asked them to come up behind me. We'd use what we had, then do what we could. 2. We came to another flight of steps, and Amit, out of breath at last by the time we got to the top of them, shifted Freed to Iota. Freed said,
"Leave me. I'm just dead weight."
"Save your breath to cool your porridge,"
I growled. It might have been porridge, as in the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It might have been soup. The corridor now tended up more steeply, like the one leading to the field. I hoped we'd reach the end soon because the reservoir of fuel in the lantern was almost gone and the light was dimming. Then, on our right, I began to hear a scratching and scrabbling beyond the tile wall, quite close. I remembered my doomed run for the outer gate, tripping over the gravestones, and the hackles on my neck rose.
"What's that?" Quilly asked. "It sounds like..."
He didn't finish. But we all knew what it sounded like. Fingers. Fingers in the earth, clawing toward the sound of our passage. "I don't know what it is," I said, which was probably a lie. Eris said,
"When his mind is not at rest, Eldon, I mean, the dead grow restless. So I've heard. It might only be a story to scare children. Even if it's true, I don't think they can get in here."
I wasn't so sure about that. I'd seen hands rising from the ground, the dead reaching into the living world. And I'd also heard the squall of rusty hinges as though something were emerging from the crypts and tombs, maybe several somethings.
"Rats is all."
That was Measle. He was trying to sound authoritative.
"Maybe voles or ferrets. Anything else. Just stories to frighten children, like she says."
I didn't really think they could get through the tile wall between us and them, but I was still grateful when we left the scratching behind. If it had been the graveyard, I had at least a rough idea of where we were, and if I was right, we were indeed close to the gate. As we reached another flight of stairs, steep and long, the lantern began to gutter.
"Leave me! Leave me!" Freed moaned. "I'm done."
"Shut up or I'll do you myself,"
I panted, and started up the stairs with Freed in his arms. I followed, and the rest followed me. At the top was a little room with benches on either side and a door. It was locked, and this time not on the inside. That would have been too easy. The handle was a rusty lever. Amit seized it, turned it, and pulled with all his might. It broke off.
"Fuck!"
He dropped it and examined his bleeding hand.
"Oi, get with me, right beside me, and hump it!"
I passed Doc Freed to Kamet and Quilly, then crowded in beside Amit, shoulder to shoulder. The flame inside the lantern gave a final jump, like a dying man's last gasp. For a moment, I could see our shadows on the white tiles, and then we were plunged into utter darkness. Jaya moaned.
"With me!" Amit snarled. "On three, hit it as damn it hard as you ever hit anything in your damn it life. 1, 2, 3!
For a moment, there was a bit of light as the door shuddered in its frame. Then we were in the dark again.
"Oh, you can hit harder than that, you fucking
pussy, cunt." I heard both overlapping.
"On three. 1, 2, 3!
The door's bolts must have been sturdy because they held. It was the hinges that gave way, sending the door flying back. Iota and Amit stumbled out. I went to his knees and Amit hauled him to his feet. The rest of us followed.
"Thank the high gods,"
Akka cried. His voice echoed back from some vast space.
"Ankh, Ankh,"
and
"Odds, Odds."
A moment later, we were enveloped in a cloud of leathery wings. 3. Eris and Jaya shrieked in perfect harmony. They weren't the only ones to cry out. I think most of us yelled or screamed in terror. I know I did. I dropped the lantern to cover my head and heard it shatter on the stone floor.
"Bats,"
Freed wheezed.
"Just bats. They roost."
He began to cough and couldn't finish, but pointed up into the deep shadows. Amit heard him and bellowed it.
"Bats! They won't hurt ye! Stand your ground and swat 'em away!"
We swung our arms, me hoping they weren't vampire bats because they were huge, like the ones in the tunnel between Illinois and Empus. I could glimpse them as they swooped and turned, because faint light, I think cloud-shrouded moonlight, was coming through a line of small, high windows. I could see most of the others, all waving their arms madly. Kamet and Quilly were carrying Freed, so they couldn't swat, but Doc himself was waving his arms feebly and coughing up a storm. The colony swooped away, back to the heights of the enormous room in which we found ourselves. This part of the trolley house appeared to be a garage. There were at least 20 trolleys in neat rows. Painted on their blunt snouts were their destinations. Seafront, Disk, Ullum, Tevo North, Tevo South, Green Isles. The posts on their roofs, meant to draw power from the overhead wires, most of those now down in the streets, hung limp and dispirited. On the sides of the ones I could see, in gold flake, were words decidedly out of vogue in Empus these days. Friendship, amity, kindness, and love.
"How do we get out?"
Stooks asked. Eris said,
"Did you never learn to read?"
"As well as any plowboy, I guess,"
Stooks said, sounding grumpy. Of course, I'd be grumpy too if I had to hold my cheek with my hand to keep the food from squirting out.
"Read that then,"
Eris said, pointing above a high central arch on the far side of the garage. Printed above it was "Way Out." We went through the arch, 13 would-be escapees falling in behind their clueless prints. We came out in a room almost as big as the garage, with a row of what had to be ticketing stations on one side and a number of smaller arches with destinations painted over them on the other. The glass of the ticket windows had been shattered. A giant butterfly centerpiece had been broken to bits, and a mural of monarchs had been splashed with paint. But the vandals hadn't been able to deface all the butterflies. High above, running all around the room, were bright yellow tiles with a monarch on each one. Seeing what Eldon's cronies hadn't been able to destroy brought me comfort. And if I was right, there might be something I could use nearby. "Come on," I said, and pointed to a bank of doors. I broke into a run. 4. We burst into the outside world, a few still swinging buckets. We huddled at the top of the steps leading down to the Galleon Road, Kamet and Quilly grunting as they carried Freed between them. I heard the clang of the Lord High's squat bus and saw a dozen or so night soldiers running in front of it, spread out across the wide thoroughfare. I had thought Kellen's little vehicle might be the only motorized transport left in Lillimar, but I was wrong. There was one ahead of the night soldiers leading the pack, and unlike the bus, it wasn't powered by electricity. It blatted and backfired as it came toward us. Enormous handlebars jutted from the front of a board wagon. 4 iron-bound wheels struck sparks from the cobbles. At the front, adding to whatever power the wagon's motor was supplying, was Red Molly, sitting on a high seat and pedaling for all she was worth. Her huge knees flashed up and down. She was bent over the handlebars like a daredevil motorcycle rider. We might have been able to beat the rest to the gate, but she was coming fast. I saw red and white striped posts. I saw the down snarl of trolley wires I'd almost tripped over, and I saw the nest of brambles into which I'd thrown my pack so I could run a little faster. I hadn't made it that time, and I wasn't going to make it this time either. None of us were. Unless that pack was still there.
"That bitch! I'll take her on!"
Iota growled, balling his fists.
"I'll stand with you,"
Amit said.
"I will, or damn it!"
"No," I said. I was thinking of Woody's nephew, Aloysius, and how Red Molly's mother had swatted his head from his shoulders.
"I, wait."
"But I can..."
I grabbed his shoulder.
"She hasn't seen us yet. She's looking straight ahead. I've got something. Trust me."
I looked at the others.
"Stay here, all of you."
Hunching low, I ran down the steps. The blatting, burping motor wagon was now close enough for me to see Red Molly's features, but she was still looking straight ahead, squinting, maybe nearsighted, and expecting to see the crowd of us running for the gate. I could have caught her by surprise, maybe, but then a small figure dressed in green breeches with the seat torn out, ran into the street, waving its arms.
"He's there!"
Peterkin screeched, pointing directly at me.
How had he seen us? Had he been waiting?
I never knew, and I never gave a shit either. That pipsqueak fuck had a way of turning up at the worst possible moment.
"He's there! Right there!"
Pointing, leaping up and down in his excitement.
"Do you not see him, you great half-blind bitch? He's right there!"
She never slowed, simply leaned down and swatted him. Peterkin rose into the air. I caught one glimpse of his face, stamped with a terminal expression of shocked surprise, and then he separated at the middle. Red Molly's blow had been strong enough to literally rip him in two. He must have risen 20 feet in the air, intestines uncoiling as he went. I thought of Rumpelstiltskin again, was powerless not to. Red Molly was grinning, and the grin revealed teeth filed to points. They hadn't found my backpack, thank God. It was still in the brambles. Thorn scrawled cuts up my bare arms as I pulled it out. I didn't feel them. One of the straps holding the pack closed slid out easily, the other bound up. I tore it away and pulled out cans of sardines, a jar of Jif, a spaghetti sauce jar filled with dog food, a shirt, my toothbrush, a pair of undershorts. Iota grabbed my shoulder. My little band of water warriors had followed him down the steps against my orders, but that was for the best after all.
I take them and run. Carry Freed yourself. The ones who still have water, they're your rear guard. At the gate, shout open in the name of Leah of the Galleon. Can you remember?
Yeah. You die now,
Red Molly screamed. Her voice was a deep baritone powered by mighty lungs.
Then go!
I waved one meaty arm at the others.
Come on, you lot. Hump it for your lives.
Most did. Amit didn't. He had apparently appointed himself my guardian. There was no time to argue with him. I found Polly's 22 and yanked it free, along with a few more cans of sardines and a package of Nabisco honeygrams that I didn't even remember packing. Red Molly stopped, 30 feet from the trolley house steps, and scrambled down from her high seat, one arm sodden to the elbow with Peterkin's blood. Amit placed himself in front of me, which was a problem unless I intended to shoot him in the head. I shoved him aside.
Get out of here, Amit!
He paid no attention, only threw himself at Red Molly with a bellow of rage. He was a big man, but next to the giant, he looked not much larger than Peterkin, now lying dead in two pieces up the street. For a moment, she was too surprised by this unexpected attack to move. Amit took advantage while he could. He grabbed one of her wide suspenders and pulled himself up one-handed. He opened his mouth and buried his teeth in her arm, just above the elbow. She screeched in pain, grabbed him by his greasy mop of hair, and pulled his head away. She balled up a fist and drove it not into his face, but through it. His eyes bulged in two different directions as if not wanting to see the red hole that had been his nose and mouth. She lifted him still with only one hand and shook that big man to and fro like a marionette. Then she threw him in the direction of the graveyard, blood fanning up from her bitten arm. Amit was brawny and fearless, but she had disposed of him as if he had been no more than a child. Next, she turned to me. I was sitting on the cobbled pavement of the Galleon Road, legs splayed, Polly's 22 automatic held out in both hands. I remembered how it had felt to have that gun pressed into the back of my head. I thought again of Rumpelstiltskin and how much Polly had reminded me of that fairy-tale dwarf. What will you give me if I spin your straw into gold? Polly would have killed me once he got Mr. Bowditch's treasure and tumbled me down the magic well hidden in Mr. Bowditch's shed. Mostly, I remember hoping that the little gun would stop a giant, just as David's little stone had stopped Goliath. It might, if it was mostly loaded. It had been fired twice already, back in a less magical world. She came toward me, grinning. Her wounded arm was pouring blood. She didn't seem to mind. Maybe Amit's final bite would start an infection that would kill her if I couldn't.
You're no prince, she said in that rumbling baritone. You're a bug. Nothing but a bug. I'll just step on you and...
I fired. The gun gave a polite bang, not much louder than the Daisy air rifle I'd had when I was 6 years old. A small black hole appeared over Red Molly's right eye. She reared back, and I shot her again. This time the hole appeared in her throat, and when she gave a howl of pain, blood jetted from the hole. It came out under so much pressure that it looked solid, like the shaft of a red arrow. I fired again, and this time the black hole, not much bigger than the period you put at the end of a sentence, appeared at the top of her nose. None of it stopped her. She screamed and reached for me. I didn't pull back or even try to dodge. That would have fucked up my aim, and it was far too late to run. She would have caught me in a pair of Mother May I giant steps. Just before she could grab my head, as she'd grabbed Amit's, I fired 5 more times in rapid succession. Each shot went into her open, screaming mouth. The first 2, maybe the first 3, took most of her teeth with them. In the War of the Worlds, our most sophisticated weapons didn't do much to stop the rampaging Martians. It was earthly germs that killed them. I don't think any single bullet from Polly's little gun did for Red Molly, nor even all 8, which was every cartridge left in the clip. I think she pulled her broken teeth down her throat and choked on them. 5. If she had fallen on me, her weight might have held me pinned until Kellen and his night soldiers arrived, or killed me outright. She had to go 500 pounds minimum. But she went to her knees, first gasping and choking and holding her bleeding throat. Her eyes bulged sightlessly. I scrambled back on my ass, tipped over on my side, and rolled. The night soldiers were closing in. I'd never beat them to the gate. And the gun was used up, slide back, chamber empty. She made one final effort to reach me, waving her wounded arm and stippling my cheeks and forehead with her blood. Then she fell on her face. I stood up. I could run, but what was the point? Better to face them head on and die as best I could. What I thought of then was my father, who would still be hoping I'd come home. He and Lindy Franklin and my Uncle Bob would have papered every town between Century and Shy with pictures of me and Radar. Have you seen this boy or this dog? The passage to Empus would be left unguarded, and maybe that was more important than one bereft father. But as the night soldiers neared, it was Dad I was thinking of. He'd gotten sober, and for what? Wife gone, son lost without a trace. But if Iota could lead the others through the gate, where I didn't believe the night soldiers could go, they'd be free. There was that.
Come on, you sons of bitches!
I screamed. I tossed the useless gun away and spread my arms wide. Behind the line of blue shapes, Kellen had stopped his little bus. Content just to watch me killed, I thought at first, but it wasn't me he was looking at. It was the sky. The night soldiers stopped, still 70 or 80 yards away. They were looking up too, with identical expressions of amazement on the gauzy human faces that overlaid their skulls. There was enough light to see by, even though the 2 ever-racing moons were hidden. A cloud below the clouds was coming over the outside wall. It was unrolling toward the Galleon Road, the fancy shops and arches, and the palace beyond, where the 3 glass-green spires shone in the lights ringing the field. It was a cloud of monarchs, the sort of group known as a kaleidoscope. They flew above me without stopping. It was the night soldiers they wanted. They halted, circled, and then dive-bombed en masse. The soldiers raised their arms, as the flight killer was said to have done after his coup, but they didn't have his power. And the butterflies didn't die. Except, that is, for the ones that struck those high-voltage auras first. There were brilliant flashes when they hit the blue envelopes. It was as if a crowd of invisible children were waving 4th of July sparklers. Hundreds burned up, but thousands more followed, either smothering the deadly auras or shorting them out. The cloud seemed to solidify as it engulfed the night soldiers. But not Lord High Kellen. His little electric bus made a tight U-turn and headed back to the palace, making good speed. Some of the monarchs broke off and chased it, but it was too fast for them, and the roof would have protected the son of a bitch anyway. The night soldiers that had been chasing us were finished, all of them. The only movement where they had been was the flutter of delicate wings. I saw one bony hand rise and then sink back into the orange-red mass on top of it. I ran for the outer gate. It was open. My party of prisoners had gone outside, but something else came in at a dead run, something black, low to the ground, and barking like hell. I had thought the only thing I wanted was to get the hell out of the haunted city of Lillimar, but now I realized there was something else I wanted more. I thought of Dora. When she'd caught sight of my dog, how she had called to her as best she could in her broken voice. My voice was also broken, not by some degenerative curse, but by sobs. I fell to my knees and held up my arms.
Radar,
Radar! Raids!
She collided with me and knocked me over, whining and licking my face from top to bottom. I hugged her with all my strength, and I cried. I couldn't stop crying. Not very princely, I suppose, but as you may have guessed already, this isn't that kind of a fairy tale. 6. A bellowing voice that I knew very well broke up our happy reunion.
Charlie! Prince Charlie! Get the fuck out of there so we can shut the gate! Come to us, Charlie!
Right, I thought, getting to my feet. And strain your pooper, Prince Charlie. Radar danced around me, barking. I ran toward the gate. Claudia was standing just outside of it, and she wasn't alone. Woody was with her, and between them, astride Falada, was Leah. Behind them were the remaining escapees from Deep Malene, and behind those were others. A crowd of people I couldn't make out. Claudia wouldn't cross into Lillimar, but she grabbed me as soon as I came through the gate and pulled me into a hug so strong I felt my spine creak.
Where is he?
Woody asked.
I hear the dog, but where?
Here, I said. Right here. This time it was my turn to hug. When I let him go, Woody put his palm to his forehead and dropped to one knee.
My prince, it was you, all along, and you've come just as the old story said you would.
Get up, I said. With tears still pouring from my eyes, plus snot from my nose that I wiped away with the back of my hand, and blood all over me, I never felt less princely in my life. Please, Woody, get up. Rise. He did. I looked at my group, watching with awe. Eris and Jaya were hugging each other. I had Freed in his arms. It was clear that some of my friends, maybe all, knew exactly who these three people were. Not just whole people, but whole people of the true blood. They were the exiled royalty of Empis, and, except perhaps for the insane Yolanda and Burton the Anchorite, they were the last of the Galleon line. Behind the dungeon refugees were 60 or 70 gray people, some carrying torches and some with torpedo lanterns similar to the one Percy had left for me. Among them, I saw someone I knew. Radar had run to her already. I went to her, barely aware that the deformed people who had been cursed by Eldin, or by the being that had used him as a puppet, were falling to their knees all around me, their palms to their foreheads. Dora also tried to go to her knees. I wouldn't let her. I embraced her, kissed both of her gray cheeks and the corner of her crescent mouth. I brought her back to Woody, Claudia, and Leah.
Close in the name of Leah of the Galleon, Claudia bellowed.
The gate began to trundle slowly shut, its machinery groaning like a thing in pain. As it did, I saw an enormous figure loping in long strides down the central thoroughfare. Clouds of monarchs swirled above and around it, some even lit on the broad shoulders and blocky head. But this was no night soldier, and the figure simply ignored them. As the gate passed the halfway mark on its hidden track, she gave a wail of grief so loud and so awful that everyone except Claudia covered their ears.
Molly!
Hannah screamed.
Oh, my Molly, oh, my dear! How can you lie so still?
She bent over her dead daughter, then stood. There were many of us gathered before the closing gate, but it was me she was looking at.
Come back!
She raised fists like boulders and shook them.
Come back, you coward, so I can kill you for what you've done to my dear one!
Then the gate crashed closed, cutting off the sight of Red Molly's bereft mother. 7. I looked up at Leah. No blue dress this night. No white apron. She was dressed in dark pants tucked into high leather boots and a quilted blue vest with a monarch butterfly, the royal crest of the Galleon,
on the left side above her heart. Around her waist was a wide belt. Hanging from one hip was a dagger. On the other was a scabbard holding a short sword with a golden hilt.
"Hello, Leah," I said, feeling suddenly shy. "I'm very glad to see you."
She turned away from me with no sign that she'd heard. She might have been as deaf as Claudia. Her mouthless face was a stone.